Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole deck with galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
We do this too, we're bringing that fire. Talking real talk, Kentucky's on fire. From bourbon to ball games, we got that flow. On the We Do This Too podcast, yeah, you know. From country roads to the city lights, they bring the heat, man, every night. We do this too, let's make it clear. If you ain't listening, you ain't here.
Welcome back, y'all. It's another edition of the We Do This Too Outdoors podcast. And as always, we are presented to you in partnership with brands that we feel represent the very best of the outdoor industry. So before we get started, we'd like to give a special shout out to Moultrie Products, Uhler's Archery, Threads Custom Bowstrings, G5 Outdoors, Blackburn Apparel Company, Deer Pip Scents and Lures, Vision Clothing, Bluebird Waterfowl Company, Angry Chicken Outdoors, Alps Outdoors, and last but certainly not least, a special, special shout out to the good folks over at Briley's for leaving a legacy of shooting innovation. Whether you need new cameras to elevate the scouting experience, new arrows, or anything for your archery setups, clothing, scent, or whatever it may be, as a supporter of the podcast, you can use promo code WDTTPROMO, that's WDTTPROMO, for 15% off anything on the website at ullersarchery.com. Some exclusions may apply. With that being said, let's dive into another episode of the We Do This Too Outdoors podcast with your host, Mr. Courtney Williams.
What's up, guys? Welcome to another edition of the We Do This Too Outdoors podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Williamson. I've got a super special guest on today, Mr. Lane Wilf of Mississippi. He is a wildlife biologist. He's got an associate's degree in forestry, a bachelor's in wildlife management. He's got a master's in biology, 24 years experience in wildlife management and environmental, in-state and federal service, Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks, deer program leader for 2.5 years. He is also a Mississippi Friction Turkey Caller Champion, a world champion turkey calling champion, Friction Turkey Calling runner-up 2023-24-25. You can catch him on YouTube. His YouTube channel is Old Biologist. So we're going to sit here. We're going to talk a little bit about, I don't know if you guys seen my last two episodes. I think it was 2 or 3 episodes ago. Me and my buddy Trey were trying to talk about EHD, CWD, and we really didn't know what we were talking about. So we've got a guy on today that is hopefully going to hash some things out for us, and hopefully we'll get a better understanding for it. But for people that don't know Mr. Land, those who may not know him, can you share a little bit about your background in wildlife biology and how your career led you into deer management?
Well, it's an interesting story. It's somewhat convoluted. I started hunting when I was 12 years old, and I basically started on my own. I started after my father was in the cattle business when I was a kid. And during the 80s, you know, you had a series of droughts and linked series of disasters, per se. And the cattle business basically went belly up. And as an aside, since I was used to being with Pop out on the farm and this and that when I was growing up, I decided that I was going to try to take up hunting. And we had a little land there behind the house, and that's just kind of where I started hunting, is the 45-acre block there behind my parents' home, and I still hunt that property to this day. That's actually my primary deer property. I have other properties that I turkey hunt, but I've been hunting that property now for 35 or so years, and have noticed that it's getting better. You know, have done a lot of habitat work on it, but that kind of led to I got into high school. And I had a larger stature. So football in the 80s and 90s, if you're a big old boy, you know, as well as I do, if you don't play football, you're a coward, especially in the deep South. And the town I grew up in, the football program was very significant, very rigorous. And a couple of years after I graduated, we actually had, I think, our team here in Amory was top 5 in USA Today in the nation.
Wow.
We had, on my senior team, we had, I think, 10 or 12 guys that played in SEC or played Division One, not SEC, but Division One. So football led me, eventually, I went to Itawamba Community College up the road. And people are not familiar with Mississippi Junior College, but the Last Chance U series that was on Netflix years ago kind of does it justice. Our team was made up of people from several states. We had a lot of guys from South Carolina. One in particular played at Philadelphia and played at the Steelers, a guy named Deuce Staley. I think he's still an assistant coach up there. But we had five guys on that community college team that played in NFL. So, and then the guy I had to block my first game was actually a guy named Grady Jackson that played at the Raiders, and that was severely indoctrinating. that was very challenging. But fast forward there, I went to Arkansas State, and I actually ended up finishing up my associate's degree in forestry at Itawamba at ICC by sending classes back. And then I got a bachelor's in wildlife and then moved into grad school and got a master's. I actually did a bat project in Delta National Forest for my master's, but fell in love with the South Delta because I saw what great hunting opportunities were on that national forest. And so I wanted to come back and work in the South Delta. When I got done with my master's, I got a job with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission in South Florida, working on a couple of wildlife management areas down there. They were much different than anything I'd ever seen. I spent a lot of time on an airboat, worked in the marsh a lot, and managed a hunting program on those two areas. After a couple of years down there, I got an opportunity to actually go back to the Delta and work the lion's share of the Delta as a district biologist working with deer clubs. And that moved me into the deer program when the Wildlife Bureau reorganized a couple of years later. And I wound up eventually working with deer clubs in 41 of 82 counties, half the state. Had to supervise a handful of other biologists and was deer program leader for a couple of years and did a lot of work supporting the enclosure program. Had a lot of skin in the game with trying to prevent CWD from getting to Mississippi. So that's a long intro, but you mentioned Anthony Dale and how we got linked up, and AD and I both played college ball. I think he said he played defensive end and linebacker at Northeast Louisiana, and I played it, I was offensive line at Arkansas State. And I shudder to think of having to be out there at a left tackle and having to block AD as a defensive end. It would be a bloody nightmare, because I could imagine AD at 20 years old, I guarantee you he had some wheels.
I guarantee you too.
And he would beat you on that edge and make you look like a fool getting in the backfield and batting down a pass or taking your quarterback out. And back in those days, when we played, you got helmet stickers for what they throw you out of the game for now.
Right.
So, yeah, that led me into the deer world. I was deer program leader for 2.5 years. It doesn't take one long being that close to the fire of the political influences in state government to realize that in many cases, what's best for the resource will be nullified by influential people's interests. And that position became untenable for me. And so I wound up taking a job at Columbus Air Force Base with USDA Wildlife Services in 2015, doing animal damage control on an airfield, basically preventing deer and birds and coyotes and other miscellaneous animals from having aircraft strike. And after about 8 years of doing that, I rotated into the Civil Engineering Squadron at Columbus Air Force Base in environmental. So that's what I do now. But I still do a little bit of deer work occasionally. And I guess the reason why I started the YouTube channel was people have been telling me for a decade that I needed to have a YouTube channel. And there's so much misinformation out there about deer management that I just wanted to offer practical advice that people could do and use on small or whatever size property, primarily focused on the deep south because that's where most of my experience is. But I decided to try to spread a little bit of wisdom as much as I could And I'm to the place where if it takes off and does anything, great. If it doesn't, and I do a half a dozen videos and grow weary of it, then that's fine too. But I'm going to try to stick it out for a few months, maybe a year, and see where it goes.
Heck yeah. It seems like you've got a pretty extensive background and everything. How did you get involved with the turkey calling?
The turkey calling was triggered by CWD. That's an interesting story. That I'm not a professional world champion. I'm a amateur world champion. I won the amateur division at the world in 2021. The only state championship I got, I won in 2021, which that's more state championships than I won in football. So I call it a huge win. I was actually this year, it's the best I've ever called in the state. I called, Jason Conrad beat me by a point and a half out of like 280 possible points. And Jason Conrad's a two-time world champion, U.S. Open champion, and consistent Grand National finalist. He was actually third in the Grand National this year. So if I lose to him by a point and a half, I call that a huge victory.
Oh, for sure.
But I started calling because February 9th, 2018, I was actually getting out of my truck at the base. It was a Friday. And I got out of my truck to go check some beaver traps. And my good friend, who's the deer coordinator here now still, he's in his last couple of years of service, but he was calling. And I almost didn't answer, but because I was kind of in a hurry. But I picked it up, and he was speaking, and it's unlike this guy because you've probably heard of William McKinley, but William McKinley is one of the best communicators on the planet, and he was obviously rattled, and I didn't understand what he was saying. He was just kind of blabbering, and he said, and of all places, it's Aquinnah County, and that's when it hit me that, oh, God, we popped positive in Issaquena County. And Issaquena County is down there in the South Delta near where I began my career far back as graduate school in 1999. I was in Sharkey in Issaquena County. And we talked about it, and he told me that it was a 3 or 4 year old buck. And ironically, it was on the oldest deer club in the state, possibly the oldest deer club in the South. There's a book out there by, I think Huffman was the guy that wrote the book, and it's basically a bunch of pictures from an old owner of the club, and it's called 10 Point Hunting Club. Now it's called 10 Point Company. It was an old Anderson Tully club. And I thought that was incredibly ironic that we popped positive on the oldest club in the state. But we began to see the handwriting on the wall and dealing with all the captive industry stuff in the state. We knew that we were going to pop positive. We just didn't know when or where. We figured it would be South Mississippi. Down there, there was a massive network of enclosures in the southern portion of the state near Louisiana at that time. And we figured that we were going to pop positive down there. And South Mississippi is not a deer hunting mecca like we were talking about. As you go further south, the deer have a tendency to get smaller. That's just Bergman's rule. But long story short, that's not what happened. Is we popped in Issaquena County in the South Delta. And for having a lot of skin in the game and trying to prevent it, it just hit me in a very bad place. I could function at work, but I'd come home and stare at the wall. I was kind of struggling with, I guess you could call it PTSD or something. It was just, I was in a very, very bad place, and it got bad enough. After about the 1st of March, my wife brought my turkey vest out and set it on the kitchen table and said, "Turkeys don't have CWD. You need to go hunting." And I said, "You're right." So I got all my stuff together and filled my vest up, and I wasn't really feeling it. But at that point, I started listening to the hunting public a little bit. I don't listen to them a lot, but I was listening to them a little bit, and they were doing an interview within that week when I started trying to take my focus off of CWD and deer and transition to turkeys. And they were talking to Dave Owens. And Brother Owens had won the Grand National that year, kind of come out of nowhere and won the Grand National. And I said, you know what? I said, I've had 10 months of my year had been occupied with deer. And 2 months were occupied with turkeys. And those were my outlets. You know, I played deer biologist when I wasn't at work because I was working for USDA at this time. And I deer hunted, and I talked to people about deer for 10 months of the year, and I've significantly focused on turkeys for two. So I decided that I've got to find something since we have CWD and we're going to watch this glacier move, and it's not a lot of good news out there right now. I'm going to have to find another outlet, and turkey calling was it. And good gosh, when I started, I was awful. I thought I was great because I was killing turkeys pretty consistently, but getting up there like we were talking about and painting that picture for the judges on that stage and making it real and trying to actually mimic a real hen with a call was an entirely different art. And it took me a couple of years to finally place in a contest. And that was in 2018 when I first started. And I did a year, I think, straight. Every day I had a mouth yelper in my mouth at some point. And still, after that, I figured out I was never going to get there with a mouth call. Or if I did, I would have to reinvent the wheel. So I decided that I would focus on friction. And now I'm doing okay. I'm not a consistent Grand National finalist or anything. I missed the finals last year by 5 points. I think this year I'll probably do a little better, so we'll just see. But the turkey calling was just an outlet to try to take my negativity away from dealing with CWD here in my home state.
I understand.
That's a long answer. That's a long answer, but everything with me has a story. So
yeah. I like it. Yeah, I've got a good friend. He's a turkey caller as well. I don't know if you know the name Stanley Williams or not.
I know Stanley Williams very well. Williams is a good friend of mine. He's cried on my shoulder, and I've cried on his. Whenever you go win one, you're on the top of the world, or you go place pretty well. And when you lose, you just, back to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I met him for the first time this year with the NWTF, Black Lightning Custom and everything, the calls he makes. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to meet him, bought a call from him, and reaches in his bag and he hands my son a call. It was like, he's the future. And my son still plays with that call to this day. He's actually getting pretty good at it. After that, I got his phone number, and we stay in contact and see how he's doing and make sure. And he's became a good friend of mine, and like I said, I'll always respect him for that, just simply for showing that little bit of love to my son. He's 7 years old at the time, and he thought that was the best gift he's ever received, man. So I'll always have a special place in my heart for him for that, for sure.
That's how Stanley is. That's the kind of guy he is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a good guy, man.
He is. He's a good fellow and a good friend.
But let's get into it. Let's get into it. So start with the basics. So you've got EHD and you've got CWD. So you've got two different diseases that do two totally different things. So can you kind of break down what each of them mean and kind of like the symptoms that come from each of them?
Let's, uh, I'm going to go through EHD first because it's the least complex of the two.
Okay.
Compare and contrast would lead to probably more confusion. But the thing that confuses most hunters is in wildlife management and government, we're terrible to throw out this alphabet soup acronym garbage. EHD stands for, get ready, prepare yourself, epizootic hemorrhagic disease. That means that it's transmissible between animals and it causes hemorrhaging, very high fever. The old timers, when they were restocking deer across the country back in the earlier part of the last century, they called it Killer X because the deer they were restocking were dying and they didn't know why. And later they figured out that this hemorrhagic disease was killing them. The common nomenclature, the common name for the disease is blue tongue. It, in real reality, it is EHD, but blue tongue is as good a catch-all name as any. So you could just call it blue tongue and get the same. It's basically blue tongue and hemorrhagic disease. They have seven different strains or serotypes in North America. Five are classified as blue tongue, two are EHD. They're carried by a virus, or they're caused by a virus. It's like the flu in people. So when a deer is exposed to a particular strain or a serotype, then they are resistant to it. They build up immunity. They have an immune response. So that one can come through and they don't get sick again. All right. So you get flu comes through in January, February with people. You get a new strain, everybody gets sick. And then that strain comes through again in a year or so, nobody gets sick. It's the same deal. So they develop a resistance to it. Deer in the deep south are more resistant to it than deer, say, up north or in the Midwest. So what winds up happening is you've got two types of reactions to HD. Some deer get acute HD, and deer that get acute HD, they don't act sick, they act dead. And they're dead within basically 48 hours, 1 to 3 days. Chronic HD is where they remain sick for an extended time period. And this is where they see the listless deer around water. A lot of times, guys that are scouting for bow season find the carcasses around creeks or ponds or whatnot. That's because they run a very high fever. I'm fixing to have to crank this vehicle again. Stand by.
Oh, you're good.
I'm hoping that this thing doesn't switch over. Am I still with you?
Oh, yeah. You're still here.
Still good. Okay. I'm hoping this thing will keep on hooked up with the AirPods and it doesn't switch over to the vehicle. So you have the high fever. The high fever interrupts.
And that gives you the telltale sign that you can see when you harvest the deer in the fall, as you see the old standby hoof sloughing. Hoof sloughing basically looks like a fingernail or a toenail that's been smashed with a hammer. So it interrupts the hoof growth. Then the hoof growth restarts, and that portion of the hoof grows off and sloughs off. Does that make any sense?
It does, yeah.
And the deer carry that through the fall until the hoof grows out. In some cases, deer will have the hoof break off, and I have seen deer so heavily injured from this interruption in the hoof growth that they're walking around on the bony nubs under their hooves. I've seen some does that were so injured and maimed from it that they were scooting around on their chest. You know, that kind of stuff.
These AirPods back up. Am I good now?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay. I'm sorry I'm having to do this in a vehicle, but I got caught out away from the house.
It's all good, man.
So they run a very high fever. they hemorrhage heavily, they internally bleed, and they have oral lesions. So they have some necrosis and blood clotting around the oral area of their mouth, basically. And that leads to the name Blue Tongue. Okay?
Okay.
So that's kind of where that came from, is those oral lesions and that hemorrhaging around their mouth. Usually HD or Blue Tongue is cyclical. So every 1 to 3 years, you'll have some mortality from it, but it comes through every year. It's carried by a small biting midge, a little no-see-em gnat. Kids, cover your ears. I call them dog pecker gnats. It's just a little biting midge. It's a little biting gnat that carries the disease, and that's the vector for it. And they were incredibly bad here this year. I don't know why we didn't have, I guess our deer were resistant to the strain that came through. I know that Northwest Alabama had a fair amount of mortality. Ohio has been rim wrecked.
Yeah, and Ohio Western, was slammed.
Yeah, Ohio got slammed. They lost a lot of old, nice bucks. Yeah, when it gets up north, it's getting more prevalent to show up north and in the Midwest. Back, I think it was 2007, 2008, Kansas had a strain come through and wiped their deer out. Now, it never kills an entire population, but it thumps them well enough to where you don't have much to hunt, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So hemorrhagic disease or Blue Tongue is not 100% fatal. In the Southeast, usually on a normal year, you're going to lose about 10% of the population in a normal outbreak. Sometimes a heavy one in the Deep South is 25%. Up north, it'll rim wreck them. It can be upwards of 50%. So it's something to be concerned about, but there's not really a whole lot you can do to offset or compensate for hemorrhagic disease. It's just there. It's going to happen. Deer have adapted to it. They have babies. They crank out fawns, and life goes on. Okay. The good news with hemorrhagic disease, for the most part, is when it frosts, it's over. When the midges go in and they die, it's over with. Okay. You'll have some mortality, but usually any mortality after frost is going to be related to a secondary bacterial infection from either hoof sloughing or some other type of injury from the disease, or when the deer was, you know, disoriented from the disease. Does that answer most of your questions about that one?
Yes, it does. I know a lot of the people around here, that's what they call it, is Blue Tongue. And I didn't know if it was the same thing as EHD or not. You know,
they're sister viruses. They're very closely related viruses.
Gotcha.
That cause either strain.
Yeah.
So and it just kind of depends on what strain you get and gets dialed up at you.
Gotcha. And then, you know, a lot of the old timers around here, you know, that's been around for a while, they're like, man, we need a good frost.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that now that makes sense, you know, that midge or whatever, that gnat that you called, you know, once that frost comes and it dies, you know, it's pretty much over with. So.
Yep. That's the ending of it. Oh, is there anything else I can answer about PhD?
Well, BHD, I think you pretty much got it down. Now, this CWD, I've heard, is a whole different animal.
CWD was first documented in a research facility in Fort Collins, Colorado in 1967. So anybody that says that deer have been living with it forever is not telling you a fact, okay? Deer have not been contending with CWD forever, otherwise we would not have deer. CWD is 100% fatal, so if they catch it, they're gonna die. The bad news is the listlessness, the hanging around water, A-frame stance, you know, drooping demeanor, all of the symptoms of CWD, especially in a clinical case, are very similar to EHD. So looking at a deer from the outside without pulling those two retropharyngeal lymph nodes out, these two lymph nodes under your jawbone here that swell up and get sore when you get sick.
Yeah.
That's the best thing to get to test for CWD, and there is no live test. The deer has to be dead to get those out. CWD is in a family of diseases called, wait for it, transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. That basically means it's transmissible. It's a disease of the brain, which is an encephalopathy, and it creates spongy holes, thus the spongiform part. So what it is prion, it's triggered, it's caused by a prion. A prion is the infectious agent. The good news about HD is it's a virus, and a virus can be killed, right? It's alive. You can kill it. A prion is a misfolded protein, so it's not alive. You can't kill it. That's the problem. Incineration at 1200 degrees does not destroy the prion. It just renders it not infectious. Okay?
Gotcha.
It's very durable. It can survive in hours of alkaline digestion. It's almost indestructible. Okay? It's kind of like Wolverine. I've often said that CWD is like a diamond. It's forever, and it's like a glacier. It moves very slow. How CWD is most commonly spread in the natural world is it's spread by one-year-old buck dispersal. So a one-year-old buck in the hot zone, his mother runs him off when he's between a fawn and a one-year-old. Nature's way of preventing inbreeding. That's why a lot of the one-year-olds you grow go to somebody else's place and they get to enjoy them. When that yearling buck disperses and he's been exposed to his mother who may have the disease, or he's been exposed to another deer that has the disease, he takes it with him. And I've seen yearling bucks disperse up to 22 miles.
Wow.
We tagged a deer, a yearling buck, near Canton, Mississippi. And the following fall, somebody killed that deer with the ear tags in Little Yazoo, and it was 22 miles away, air miles. So
Yazoo City.
Yeah, Little Yazoo, south of Yazoo City, over off Highway 49.
Home of Jerry Clower.
Jerry Clower lived there. Yeah, I lived there when I was working in District 3 back in the day. It was a cool place to live. But so that's the natural way it disperses. Unfortunately, how it generally moves around is in a truck, 70 miles an hour in a trailer. In many cases, or it can move with a carcass. Somebody kills the positive deer, hauls it home, discards the bone marrow, lymphatic tissue, saws the skull plate off and throws the brain out there in the gut pit. It's off to the races then. Those prions just create a bed there. And it is persistent in the soil. And it is uptaken through plants, and it can be passed through plants. Crows can eat a carcass and fly off with it, and it can go through their digestive tract and pass out as feces. And it can be infectious that way.
That makes any sense. Can you still hear me?
Oh, yeah. I can hear you good.
Okay. Prions accumulate in the brain tissue and they trigger other prions or other cells or proteins near them to misfold and become these prions. The other piece of bad news about this disease is the incubation period can be 18 to 24 months.
Mm.
So the deer has the disease and is walking around shedding prions through saliva, urine, and feces for a year and a half to 2 years before they ever become clinical. Usually they become clinical through seasonal stress, either late winter, late summer. All right. So they can be walking around sick for up to 2 years, 18 months, getting other deer sick. And this disease or this prion is transmissible through an amount. I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it, but the best way to describe it is you take one drop of saliva the size of a grain of sand on a corn pile, and that's transmissible. Okay?
Wow.
So one grain of sand of saliva can transmit and infect another deer. This disease, like I said, began in Fort Collins in 1967. It was first ID'd in whitetails in 01. It moved around in elk and mule deer in the 70s and 80s in Colorado and Wyoming, and then in the mid-90s it showed up in a captive facility in Saskatchewan. It moved around the West until 2000, and then it was found in Wisconsin in 2002. And now it's found in 36 states and 5 provinces. And I think it's in Norway, Sweden. It's in other countries with ungulates. All right. And live tests are basically unreliable. So live tests, you might get a 70% accuracy on it. How we confirm a positive is we've got some lower rigor tests that are not as expensive, like RT Quick and ELISA. And if you pop positive on one of those, then they send it to the gold standard test that is IHC, immunohistochemistry test. That's the gold standard. That's where you know you have a positive or not. Like I explained, the Mississippi CWD1 in Issaquena County was personally painful to me. But then the following fall, we found some in Marshall County and rapidly followed behind Benton County. But the prevalence was kind of hit and miss. And shortly thereafter, they found the Tennessee outbreak at Ames Plantation, if you remember that.
Yeah, I do.
So that's kind of a quick history and a rundown on how it got to moving in Mississippi, Tennessee, and now we're just trying to slow it down. Another thing that people need to be cognizant of if they are hunting around in a hot zone or a positive area is that it binds to stainless steel. So if you're cleaning a deer in a fairly high prevalence area for CWD, you need to have a throwdown knife. You need to put your meat in a cooler that you can discard. You don't need to be using a $150 or a Yeti cooler or something. You need to be using a cheaper cooler. The one upshot right now probably should have led with this, but it has not been documented to be transmissible to humans from eating the meat.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask you.
So it's not documented, but it has jumped to feral swine in Arkansas. It's jumped to raccoons. It's, you know, the little worms that fall out of deer's noses when you're cleaning them, nasal bots. Uh-huh. They get it hot as a firecracker.
Oh, man.
Raccoons have caught it. It's jumped from raccoons back to deer. It's jumped to macaque monkeys and humanized mice. So that's mice with human DNA. So I'm telling you that it has not been shown to jump to humans. However, that probability is not zero. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Yep, sure does.
So the biggest problem with this disease when you get it, as the naysayers are prone to say, and a lot of people poo-poo the disease. They say it's not real. They say it's a government plot to destroy deer. Let's talk turkey, okay? Deer are the goose that laid the golden egg for conservation. 90 to 95% of the hunters out there hunt deer. So why would state agencies facilitate something that would jeopardize their primary revenue source? Mm-hmm. That's just a poor decision. All right. That's irrational. They also like to use statewide data, like Mississippi right now. We're probably at a record deer population at this state at the present. And we have 18 positive counties. And we have one or two portions of counties that the populations have tanked. Northern Benton County, Northern Marshall County, there were properties up there that guys used to hunt. They don't hunt them much now, but they were seeing, even the first year after they popped positive, they were seeing 15, 20 deer a hunt. And I think last year or year before last, one of those landowners said they hunted the entire season and saw three deer.
Mm.
The entire season. Now that was CWD coupled with a hemorrhagic disease outbreak. But deer without CWD can overcome hemorrhagic disease. Deer with CWD, you just have fewer of them. You follow what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I got you. Yep.
So my point, I guess, and what I would say to the naysayers is they like to use the statewide record harvest data to refute CWD have an impact on the population. But you and I know that each individual property is specific. It has its own numbers. It has its own habitat. It has its own soil. You can't manage a property on the Mississippi Delta like you would manage a property in these red hills over here where I'm close to right now.
Right.
It's just apples and oranges. Right. So to see the impacts of CWD, you have to go to that specific location. All right. And University of Georgia just did a study in Arkansas. And I guess I'm going to backtrack 1 second, but you have a lot of people out there that don't want to believe in CWD. They think it's a government hoax. They think it's a scam. I guess I'm going to quote William on this one. Is CWD, it's kind of like Satan. It doesn't care what you think. It's going to do its thing.
Right.
It doesn't care if you believe in it or not. It's going to do what it does. And if you don't believe it, I would invite anybody that says that they don't believe it, let's take a show enough hot one and carve out the back straps and grill it up. And not only would I challenge you to eat it, but would you allow your child to eat it?
Right.
Because every deer I kill, and I'm not right on top of a hot zone, but since 2012, I have tested every deer I have put up because I knew it was here, but I just didn't know where. So every deer that I feed to my daughters and my wife, I test it before I process it. And I process my own deer because of the prions binding to stainless steel. I don't want to run it through, you know, a processor that's ground up 75 others in the last week, if you follow what I'm saying. I'm not trying to put processors out of business. I'm just saying for me that works, okay? But I'm the guy that knew too much about it. The UGA study in Arkansas. First thing they saw was a 13 to 15% population decline annually. Let that sink in a second. 13 to 15%. In the hot zone, I think it's up there in Newton County, Arkansas. Check this number out. 1.2 deer per square mile. That's a deer per 400 acres. How many 50s you gonna grow with that?
None.
None. The bucks die first because the bucks interact with so many more deer moving from family group to family group of does throughout the rut. So that's why bucks are more prevalent to have it. The friend zone miles away, I think it's about 10 miles away. I'm not sure. 5 deer per square mile.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Eczema is unpredictable, but you can flare less with Ebglyss, a once-monthly treatment for moderate to severe eczema. After an initial 4-month or longer dosing phase, about 4 in 10 people taking Ebglyss achieved itch relief and clear or almost clear skin at 16 weeks. And most of those people maintain skin that's still more clear at 1 year with monthly dosing.
Ebglyss, lebrikizumab, LBKZ, a 250 milligram per 2 milliliter injection, is a prescription medicine used to treat adults and children 12 years of age and older who weigh at least 88 pounds or 40 kilograms with moderate to severe eczema, also called atopic dermatitis, that is not well controlled with prescription therapies used on the skin or topicals, or who cannot use topical therapies. Ebglyss can be used with or without topical corticosteroids. Don't use if you're allergic to Ebglyss. Allergic reactions can occur that can be severe. Eye problems can occur. Tell your doctor if you have new or worsening eye problems. You should not receive a live vaccine when treated with Ebglyss. Before starting Ebglyss, tell your doctor if you have a parasitic infection.
Ask your doctor about Ebglyss and visit ebglyss.lilly.com or call 1-800-LILY-RX or 1-800-545-5979.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/M365Copilot.
Well, the holidays have come and gone once again, but if you've forgotten to get that special someone in your life a gift, well, Mint Mobile is extending their holiday offer of half off unlimited wireless. So here's the idea. You get it now. You call it an early present for next year. What do you have to lose? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Limited time 50% off regular price for new customers. Upfront payment required. $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds may slow after 50 gigabytes per month when network is busy. See terms.
That's more than 100 acres per deer.
That's insane.
Yeah, 5 deer per square mile.
Wow. Over
time, CWD eventually reached a 19.4% mortality rate. That is offsetting hunting. And it's kind of troubling because in the beginning stages of it, you want people to keep hunting and you want them to shoot deer to reduce the density. But later on, when it gets at a higher prevalence rate, up there around 23, 24, 25% prevalence, that's 23 or 24, 25 deer out of 100 have it. Once it reaches that point, you have to throttle back on the harvest because CWD is killing the deer that you would have killed hunting at that 19.4% mortality rate. You follow what I'm getting at? It's a numbers game.
Yeah, numbers.
So at the beginning stages, you want to try to reduce the density and kill more deer. But then as the disease gets a stronger toehold, you have to back off. So agencies wind up having to send mixed messages, and it kind of hurts their credibility, but they're just trying to follow the signs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a terrible conundrum, okay? I'm going to flip over here to my other page, and I'm getting real close to the end of this thing. But another phenomenon we saw, we talked about those lower deer densities where the guys were hunting in Benton County, Mississippi, and they were seeing two or three or four deer a year, a hunting season, weren't getting any on trail camera. In Arkansas, we think that got introduced in the mid to late 80s. So fast forward 30 to 35 years, we're seeing this 19.4% mortality at this 23% prevalence, okay? When you get into higher deer densities like Benton and Marshall County, Mississippi, up there north of Highway 72, that happens in about, you see 30 years worth of impact in about 10 or 15. So it happens over twice as fast. And when you move into a situation like we have on the Big Black Corridor of Mississippi, or Claiborne County is now positive. So you start talking about that southwest Mississippi, those lursal soils, those higher deer densities, where you look at properties with a deer per 3 acres, how fast is that disease going to move? And how fast is it going to reach that 25% prevalence where you can't hunt there anymore? At least you can shoot a few bucks, but that's about it.
Right.
It's a lot to think about. And I want to drive home the point is that EHD, the virus can be killed. This prion is not alive, so you can't kill it. It just moves. It's very slow. It's like a glacier, but it is very permanent, and it is 100% fatal. So I just kind of want to encourage your audience to think about the long-term consequences. And I've got a few things I want to throw out that are possible solutions. There are no rosy silver linings to this cloud, but there are ways for us to buy some time. I have had some interactions with some people in the captive industry that were positive. A lot of people in the captive industry have accepted the fact that, yes, it's real. Yes, it's here. We have to find a way to deal with it. So maybe down the road, science can find a way to beat this disease. But right now, all we got is some best management practices to try to slow it down. So if you're within an area of potential risk, if you're in a CWD management zone, I would cease and desist all supplemental feeding most Ricky Tick. Be done with it. Nothing's absolute, and you're not curing the disease by not feeding, but you are slowing it down, and you're not getting deer nose to nose. And, you know, we don't want to eat out of the same bowl when we eat chili, even with our family. You know, we don't want to get a bowl of chili the size of a truck hood and everybody just dip their spoon in it and get at it, you know. We don't want to eat that way. So you've got urination, defecation, and salivation at these feed sites. And those are three of the primary vectors. We need to try to avoid nose-to-nose contact. And there's nothing, it's like Cuz Strickland says, nothing is absolute. So there's no guarantee anything's going to work. You just buy yourself time by using some of these practices. But some of the things I tell people that they ought to consider, if you're reasonably close to a CWD positive, I don't feed anyway. I don't think in the Deep South, personally, I don't think you need feed, even if people around you feed to kill deer. On my little 45 acres, I don't have a kernel of corn on it. And I kill a deer per 10 acres I kill 4 or 5 deer on that 45 acres a year without corn. I'm not throwing rocks at people that do feed, but simultaneously, I've just known enough that there is an inherent risk. And it's really bad on turkeys, but that's a whole nother discussion. But if you're reasonably close to a CWD positive, I would immediately stop feeding and I would stop the mineral supplements. No dicalphosphate, phosphate, no mineral salt, nothing. I would definitely keep hunting for the time being until I had multiple positives on my place. I would keep hunting. That's the best tool that the agencies have, is hunters out there, boots on the ground, killing deer and turning in samples. I'm going to follow with that with, please submit CWD samples. Even if you're not in a zone, I'm not in a zone, but I turn in samples every year. A lot of your buddies are going to poo-poo you potentially. You're not going to be the most positive or popular kid on the block, but I would encourage you to submit samples and give these agencies some data to work with. Same token, if you're around a CWD management zone, make sure that you're conscious of not reusing knives if you clean a positive deer with it, and don't reuse the cooler. And if you clean your own or you process your own deer, don't run them through the meat grinder if you have a thought that they may be positive, okay? Because the prions stick to the stainless
steel. They stick to stainless steel.
Yeah. You can clean your knives with bleach solution, a significant chunk of bleach. I think it's like 25% bleach solution. You can treat it with that.
Going again. The cord keeps cutting off on me.
Yeah, you're good.
I would encourage you to just submit samples, get in the fight, and if you have a positive, you shoot a positive doe, go to that location within a half mile, quarter mile. The first thing I would try to do is, if you shoot a doe and she's got a couple of fawns and a one-year-old or a two-year-old, you got a family group going on there, all right? You shoot that doe and she's hot, you go back and you try to kill that whole family group. You follow me?
Because
that whole family group is going to have it.
Right.
So, and furthermore, I would try to hunt heavily and test heavily within a half a mile to a mile of that positive. And the state agency should be willing to work with you and get you tags and help you contend with that. All right. I would also, I know that you're sponsored by a deer lure company, and I'm not throwing rocks. I don't know what they provide. I don't know nothing about them. I think it's Deer Pimp or whatever.
Yeah, he's so Deer Pimp, he's got his own deer farm. Yeah. So he gets, collection and stuff like that, yeah.
Okay, well, I would just be cautious in using deer lures based on actual urine, because that is one of the transmissible substances. And I'm not saying that he got it. He may be testing, maybe doing everything perfectly legal and correct, and he may be testing every deer that dies in his facility. I don't know. But I'm just saying that legitimate deer lures could be a thing. So we've recommended synthetic deer lures if you want to use them. A lot of people are going to continue to use them to hunt with, and I'm not throwing rocks. I'm just saying that is a possible way to introduce the disease, because it is spread by urine, and it's also spread by feces and saliva, and it's also spread by semen that's, transported between captive facilities. So those are all things to be conscious of, just because you're sampling and just because you're trying to do everything right, just the slightest mistake can cost you dearly. And once it's there, it's there. All right. So I say all that to say is CWD is something to be concerned about. I'm of the opinion that we can work with it, slow it down, and maintain our hunting quality in places where it's not for an extended time period. And we might be able to keep this thing at bay until we find a way to beat it.
Right.
I'm cautiously optimistic that we can find a way to beat it down the road. Right now, we do not have that tool, but best management practices and in locations where you have a positive, keeping the density down and slowing the spread, keeping feed and bait off the ground in those localities is key. I guess I say this is kind of like the old football player mentality. You can't just go lay down.
Right.
Deer are too important. They're too important to conservation as a whole. And as biologists and as hunters, you know as well as I do, you don't kill a bad old gobbler by crying uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't win a fight like this by crying uncle. And this is indeed a fight.
Mm-hmm.
It's the challenge of our hunter generation. The previous generations had challenges with reintroduction. Then they had challenges with overpopulation and trying to politically make movement to harvest does. And our fight now is CWD.
Right.
Hemorrhagic disease is small potatoes compared to this. It's one of those things that's kind of like a nuclear bomb. You wish you could uninvent it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm cautiously optimistic that if hunters are unified, and I'm talking about state biologists, captive industry people, all of the hunting public, the more this information gets out there, and the more people accept the fact that we have to change. The biggest problem with CWD and the biggest reason people don't want to deal with it is it requires them to change.
Right.
And you have to turn in samples if you want to feel comfortable feeding it to your 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 9-year-old son or daughter. Because young people most definitely don't need to eat a positive deer. Every time somebody eats a positive deer, it's a science experiment of whether it jumps to people or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's got a long incubation, 18-month incubation period in a deer, if, Lord hope it doesn't, it jumps to people, how long would that incubation period be?
Right.
You know, it's a lot to think about. So,
yeah.
That is the difference between CWD. That's the long answer. Longish answer for the difference between EHD and CWD is EHD is cyclical. Deer can't overcome it. It's pretty well out there in a constant presence. CWD, if it had been around for as long as hemorrhagic disease has, we would not have deer.
Mm-hmm.
And it can spin. The human version is called Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. And it basically does the same thing. A mad cow is a sister disease to it. And cattle, scrapie's a sister disease in sheep. The difference between mad cow is that it doesn't transmit through saliva and feces. They were actually taking bones and grinding up bones to boost off the protein in the cattle feed. They were using the bones as a filler for the feed. And they were feeding a animal material to an herbivore. So cattle to get bovine spongiform encephalopathy is mad cow. To get that, they had to commit cannibalism.
Hmm.
It wasn't transmissible like CWD is.
Gotcha.
They quit feeding cattle feed with bone filler and mad cow went away. So with that, or do you have any other questions?
So from a wildlife biologist standpoint and a hunter standpoint, like what message would you want to leave to the hunting community about staying informed and, you know, doing their part about turning in samples and doing their part to, you know, try to slow this thing down?
first thing I would say is we need to stop blaming each other. Try to work with your state biologist. Try to understand that most of your state biologists are hunters. They are in a thankless job. It's not, the pay is not real good either. And I would just ask you to be considerate to those guys and gals out there and to get your deer tested. It's kind of like a cancer diagnosis. Would you rather find out when it's treatable, or would you rather find out when it's stage four and you got 2 months?
Right.
It's still there doing its thing, even if you don't know it.
Right.
Blissful ignorance is not, the train's still going to hit you if you're standing on the track. So get your deer tested. If you're standing in the path of this disease or you're hunting in the path of it, just consider getting your deer tested. And if and when it comes back positive, be willing to change, because we're going to have to change. We're going to have to adapt. I would definitely look at feeding critically. I've been on a couple of properties. One was 2,000 acres. One was 8,000 acres. And the 2,000 acre property never fed. And deer visibility on that property was higher than anywhere I've ever hunted. So consider that feeding limits deer movement, okay? If you take their stomach out of the equation and they can get 20 to 30% of their daily ration at a feed pile, you're not going to get an abundance of daylight pictures at that feed site, especially of older bucks. You will early, the least little bit of pressure, they go underground and it's over. So I would encourage you to look at feeding critically. I would encourage you to think about the impacts of feeding from a hunting perspective. So you're going to drive deer to be more nocturnal. The 8,000 acre property that I mentioned fed, and then they stopped feeding. And when they stopped feeding, their deer visibility tripled or quadrupled in daylight. So just let that property was on the Mississippi River in Arkansas, Mississippi. The other property was in northeast Mississippi here in a heavily persecuted portion of the state, and they saw fair numbers of deer all the time in daylight. So keep the pressure down in conjunction with less feeding. And I guess another troubling trend I've seen over the last 15 years is that hunters are not true woodsmen anymore. Because we've got a whole generation of young hunters that have been trained that you hunt deer over a feeder.
Right.
So they don't know dendrology. They don't know trees. They don't know high preference acorns versus low preference acorns. Or even what trees, some cases, what trees drop. You could point to a swamp chestnut oak over here and they wouldn't know what it was. I see it and my radar goes up. So I would caution people to work on woodsmanship. Try to become a true woodsman instead of just a shooter. We need to revert back to some old school skill sets. I think you were talking with a guy on your last podcast. I think you were talking about an uncle of yours that was always telling yarns and thought he would tell a yarn and then it turned out to be true. Somebody killed some 20-point buck or something. Well, those guys from that generation, they had some woodsmanship skills. They knew how to read sign. They knew how to find travel corridors. They knew what trees deer were going to hit. They knew how to find a feed tree. And they knew how to hunt the edge of two habitats coming together. And I guess that would be my encouragement is try to work on those skills.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I definitely appreciate you coming on and, you know, a lot of information.
I appreciate you having me. I hope I didn't step on too many toes, but this is kind of like my turkey calling. It's just raw and unfiltered, man.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, it was a lot of information you gave. So I think a lot of the listeners, man, will definitely tune in and kind of understand it more, because I definitely understand it a lot more now. Because, you know, Google kind of gives you a Google sometimes hard to understand when it comes to stuff like this. And then you get, you know, Google, then you got somebody that kind of knows what they're talking about, but they really don't. And then they give you some misinformation about this, this, and this. So it's like, it's good to have somebody on that actually knows this stuff, you know, like the back of their hand. So,
well, I'm not the best expert in the locality. You know, the deer coordinator here in Mississippi is probably one of the greatest minds on CWD in the country. And he and I are close friends, but, he shares a lot of information with me, and I just try to add to the pile of pooling of less ignorance when I can. So, I understand it to a degree, but nobody fully understands it because we don't know how to beat it yet.
Right.
So, but I do appreciate you having me on. And if any of the listeners, I'm going to be doing a few videos over the next handful of weeks on some habitat stuff on my YouTube channel at Old Biologist. So I've got a handful of videos up already. One of them on deer browse pressure and what plants to look for that have been smoked on your property that may suggest you have too many deer. So if I got to work on my videography. I'm not a video guy, and I'm not real good at tech either, but it's moving along. So
that's good.
I appreciate the opportunity to be on here, buddy.
Thank you, bud. Like I tell everybody, man, is there anything that I could ever ask, you know, do for you? Just let me know. You got my number. We know some of the same people, you know, maybe we can hook up one day and get out in the woods together.
Well, I should be, at least if you're at the NWTF convention, I should be there unless I'm sick or dead. So come to the call room and listen to us yelp real loud.
Sounds good to me. Yeah, I love it. It's turkey hunting is one of them things, man. I love it, but I hate it at the same time. It's a grind. I can't tell you, you know, I got my fair share of, you know, fans in here, but I've missed my fair share as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's just part of it. But you know, the love is still there, but at the same time, man, it can be a struggle, you know.
It can be, but sometimes, to quote a great prophet I used to work with, you got to shoot your way out of it.
Right.
You got to shoot your way out of it. I love everything about turkey hunting. I love the struggle. I love the misses. I love everything but crippling one.
Yeah,
for sure. If I clean mess one, you know, I'll just laugh it off and go on.
Yeah, that's what you got to do, man.
Mm-hmm.
Can't dwell on it.
even I miss sometimes.
Well, guys, this has been another episode of We Do This Two Outdoors podcast with Mr. Lan Wilf, wildlife biologist. I hope you have learned a lot about EHD and CWD like I have on this episode. So, you know, send this to your friends, send this to all your buddies. Make sure you give it a like. Leave a review, especially on Apple and Spotify for me. It helps me out, helps the podcast out. This will be out on Sportsman's Empire as well. My personal YouTube page, Spotify, Apple Podcast. So, wherever you get your podcast, it will be there. And just want to thank Mr. Land to be on today. Hopefully, we can, you know, possibly get out in the woods together one of these days.
That would be awesome.
And if you have any questions, if you got any questions for him, reach him at Old Biologist on his YouTube channel. And make sure you give him a follow. Watch some of his videos. I've been watching, you know, some of them just to kind of learn. I'm a learner. I always like to learn something new every day, you know, especially being in the education field. I love to learn something new every day. So if you guys tune in, this episode will be out pretty soon. So big game, small game, all game, guys. We do this too. I appreciate y'all.
Thank you.
It's your boy C. Will. What the hell?
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.